Welcome to the Transformation Cafe, a weekly half hour of light, topical conversation about spirituality, healing, energy, alternative medicine, higher levels of consciousness, and other insights. We're glad you're here. Transformation Cafe, a fun place to nourish your soul. Now, let's get started and introduce our diners for tonight's show.
So I want to thank everybody for joining us here at the Transformation Cafe. We are so lucky. We have just a wonderful guest chef in the house, and we're not live tonight. We're actually recording because we've got a guest from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Alan Pritz is going to be our guest tonight. Alan, how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing wonderfully. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And just so you guys know, Alan just really has all different kind of wonderful things. He has been just a lifelong follower of meditation. He has a passion for meditation. And we're going to be talking about, he has a couple different books. We're going to be talking about his current book.
It's Meditation as a Way of Life, Philosophy, and Practice. And it's rooted in the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda.
So Alan is a minister, a reverend, and it's awakened life meditation and spiritual training that he does. And he's had a lifelong calling for teaching. And he has over 38 years of spiritual practices, and he teaches meditation. And, again, he's an in-faith minister, a yogi, consultant, and has presented at the National Conference, plus was selected by the U.S. Army Reserves as a meditation and life balance resource for the Veterans Social Integrated Programs. So that's quite a mouthful.
It is indeed.
I know. So, again, I'm just so thrilled to have you on the show. So we're going to talk about meditation tonight, and we've actually been doing a series. If you go back to our last few shows, we've had Lauren, which is she's a yoga teacher here in Riverside, California, and her studio is called Source, and we got to talk a little bit about meditation, but I've also been a follower of meditation and yoga pretty much for the last 30, 35 years as well, so this should be a very interesting conversation. So what led you to want to go ahead and write your book about? You've already had one book called The Pocket Guide to Meditation. So if people want to go back and look at that, so you could talk about that a minute, about how you went from having something as a pocket guide into something that's really looking at it from a philosophical and practical practice.
Well, sure. Actually, the first book, The Pocket Guide to Meditation, I wrote way back in 1997. And it was an intentionally small, succinct, but substantive book. Trying to provide quality nuggets of information that could be easily absorbed without a lot of other culture kinds of barriers that might be confusing for people. And it did very well, and it is still available online and that sort of thing. But it was a succinct, smaller, intentionally so kind of book. And since I've been doing this stuff for such a long period of time, as you rightly noted, my inner calling has always been about teaching. Spiritual teaching and meditation in particular is my passion. And over the years doing this kind of work, I've noticed just an increasing hunger, if you will, for learning more about meditation and being able to provide some kind of vehicle for people to have quality information that they could integrate into their daily lives was really kind of the calling for me. And what I found is that, I don't sort of hold the space like some of the top flight yogis and masters. I'm just a guy in the trenches who's been doing this stuff for a long time. And so what I wanted to do was provide quality information, really sound, substantive material for people, and give a certain personalized flavor in terms of this has been a path that I've practiced and used, and these are very kinds of scientific principles that you can apply within your own life, and to know that I have used this kind of stuff myself, and this is why it works, what the goals are, and how you can achieve things yourself with it. And fundamentally, it's simply a way for me to be able to reach what I felt was an increased hunger and need, basically from people that I continued to see more and more over time.
That's wonderful. So what prompted you to go to just really going into the philosophical and then again the practices that are rooted with Yogananda?
Well, what I found is that in Western society, most things have entered in through the medical model. And, you know, you can't blame it. It's just where we are. And so, you know, historically, things about meditation really developed some kind of acclaim and acceptance, if you will, when they were presented through the healthcare system, when science was looking at meditation and what it could do for your blood pressure, what it could do for chronic pain. And those are important entry points. But the truth is that meditation is and always has been a spiritual practice. It's much more than just kind of a medical feel-good, calmness, creativity. All those things are byproducts. But the reality is that it is a spiritual practice. And regardless of what faith tradition a person adheres to, if one looks at these things, they will always find some kind of internal meditative element that goes along with it. Now, I am fundamentally trained in yogic traditions. As noted, my roots go into the Paramahansa Yogananda Kriya Yoga tradition. However, the principles and practices of these things are universal and can be applied for people regardless of what their faith tradition may be, even if they don't have one, and yet they feel some kind of spiritual hunger that they're looking to fulfill. So when I wrote this book, it was important to address the spiritual core elements and to provide an understanding for people about why that's an important thing and what are the practices that will help people get the biggest bang for their buck. I'm the kind of person that if I do something, if I dedicate myself to something, I want to know why, what is the practice, why would I even want to engage in it, what are the end results, why is that important, and how will the things that I'm doing achieve those. So I wanted to provide all that to the best of my ability for other people who I don't think I'm alone. They want to have quality information, so here it is.
That's awesome. Yeah, I love that biggest bang for my buck.
Yeah. Well, it's consumer talk, but, you know, there's no reason not to be practical with this. You know, people, if they're doing something, if you're shopping, you know, people will look at labels. They want to know where it came from. They want to understand, you know, what's this going to do for me? Why would I want to use this exercise program? Why would I want to eat this? Well, the same thing applies for spiritual practices and meditation. Why would I want to meditate? What's in it for me? And so on and so on and so forth. So I apply myself to that.
I think that's one thing that, you know, as a person who's meditated for 30 years, it's that, I don't know, just speaking on a personal level for me, I know that I've really come to a place in my life where, you know, life is a meditation. You know, it's like a walking, you know, mindful meditation. And do you really talk about in the book about being a witness and really coming from a place of kind of watching your life as opposed to having it where you get caught up in it? You can be just that much more of a person who can appreciate what's in front of you, hopefully on a moment-to-moment basis.
Well, see, now you bring up a very good point. A couple things I'd like to spin off from this. First of all, there are a lot of people that have been interested in meditation over time, but they haven't had quality information about it. So there's kind of a dalliance with it. Some people have, you know, I can't tell you the number of times people have told me, well, yeah, I'd like to, but I can't, or I've tried, but, and, you know, I frankly have to say they have not been trained well. And then secondarily, what has been very popular in Western culture right now is a Buddhist-rooted mindfulness or vipassana practice, which very much talks to the language that you're addressing in this kind of moment-to-moment, almost Zen-like mindful awareness. And that has a hugely important role in spiritual practice. I'll say perhaps distinct flavor of my book is that it's not necessarily rooted in that mindfulness tradition. It is more rooted in, and mindfulness tradition tends to be kind of non-theistic. It doesn't use language about God or spirit or what have you. It's more about awareness, consciousness, being present, etc. The elements that I apply in my book are more theistic. They draw upon language, and people can turn it in their minds to however it works for them, but it does involve a personal relationship with the divine, however you relate to it, and it's a series of practices that takes a person deeper in that relationship. And then you apply the outlook that surrounds all that in your daily act of life and living.
Mm-hmm. So you're really basing it with Yogananda. What really is that core that is so important compared to other ways that people have been taught to meditate with Yogananda, as opposed to other teachings that are out there that really gave you a passion to want to really define that for people in your book?
Right. Well, Yogananda is a unique character. And mind you, he happens to be my teacher, my guru, but I'm also very sensitive about not, proselytizing. I feel that the spiritual technologies and principles that I talk about can be equally applied to people, whether they're Christian, Hindu, Muslim, Jewish, whatever. It just works. And the principles are sound. It's kind of like gravity. There's no Christian gravity or Jewish gravity or Hindu gravity or Muslim gravity. There's just gravity. And the same thing applies with spiritual principles as well. Now, Yogananda, when he was invited to the country in 1920, the International Congress of Religious Liberals, and it was his mission to basically stay in the United States in the West and teach for the next 32 years. So he was the first spiritual master of the yogic tradition that came and stayed. And his autobiography of a yogi is probably one of the most seminal books in Western spiritual literature, having been a launching off and influencing point for so many people in their spiritual journeys. For me personally, I find that his particular approach is one that is well suited to a Western audience, because it addresses things from a very psychophysiological, scientific perspective, as well as weaves into it the elements of spirituality that are present in so many different faith traditions. And so for me, I use it personally. It resonates on a very deep level. But I also feel that the qualities that are addressed are equally compelling to people. They simply make sense.
Yeah, I was looking at your, if you go to Spirit Unlimited Events, he's got a wonderful little story on there about the autobiography of a yogi, and that how your college philosophy professor actually knew him, and some of the wild stories that they got to share.
Right. Well, and frankly, that was an amusing one.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know that my professor, when I was in school, this is one of those curious twists and turns of life. When I went through school, I went to McAllister in St. Paul. My former philosophy professor, David White, we had a great relationship and life evolved. I went off, did my things. I came back to the Minnesota area, and I found out after having done so that David actually had known Yogananda directly, and that he had been frankly, a disciple of Yogananda's, but it was just something that I didn't know at the time. So it's kind of a curious way of circuits being connected. And so just a story.
Yeah, it's a wonderful story, though, and I think it really goes back to the book and just showing on some levels, it's always like, I'm meant to write this. I'm meant to know these things. It's just a part of, if you want to call it my destiny. You know what I mean? I think it goes into that.
True.
Yeah, I think it totally goes into that.
Yeah, when you look back on life, sometimes you see these really kind of amusing points that connect, mm-hmm. that at the time you have no idea, but when you're looking back, you say, this is a script, and I'm just kind of acting it out.
Right. Now, you were, I had you write up some questions of different things that we could talk about, and you were saying that I was asking about, what really drew you to meditation to begin with? What were some of those things that wanted to go ahead and try it and see what that was all about?
Right. Well, it may be no surprise, but I was always drawn to spirituality from when I was very little. So for me, this was just an innate calling from when I was just a toddler. And it manifests itself over time. My earliest participation in these things was in martial arts. I was involved in martial arts for 10 years, an instructor in several different systems. And during that time, not only was I very interested in the physical training, but almost more so was I interested in the energetic and the spiritual elements. And during that time, I did a lot of reading of Eastern mysticism, and it coincided with my scholastic activities. And it effectively, it just kind of matured into, I know now that I've done this and I need to make a commitment which is closer to my passion about spiritual practice and meditation in particular. And after having read Autobiography of a Yogi, I found myself strongly pulled out to the West Coast to pursue training in that tradition, became certified to teach in what I do, and that's kind of the long and short of it. So it was launched as a kid, and basically took a very curious adventure. And a good portion of that I discuss in my book as well.
Oh, okay. So what part of California did you go to?
Well, initially I wound up going the Sierra Nevada foothills. And I completed a teacher training program with a fellow who had been a direct disciple of Yogananda. I was in a community, and it was a very enjoyable experience, but I didn't want to stay up in the mountaintops, and I left, and my journey just simply continued to unfold, and I wound up being in the West Coast for about 6 years, and then came back to Minnesota effectively to launch into a way of applying these teachings in a consulting practice, and then in operating meditation-based yoga centers. And now I went on to become an interfaith minister and to open up a practice where I work with people privately and continued. It's just repackaging teaching in different ways.
Yeah, I love what you talk about when you were going into just a business sense about, you know, do what you love and the money will be there, and the fact that that's not necessarily true, because it's really working.
Yeah, you know, if you build it, they're not necessarily going to come.
Yeah, exactly. I can plant a bunch of cornfields, but that doesn't mean anybody's going to come walking out of them. You know how that goes.
Right. That's kind of magical thinking. And I remember being at a conference, actually, when, you know, do what you love and the money will follow. The person who kind of popularized that was there doing a talk. And I challenged that, and you could feel the sort of stink bomb go off in the room. It was, but, you know.
Boo. Alan's a party pooper. Ooh. Okay.
I'm sorry. This isn't necessarily true.
Guy. Yeah, exactly. And I think that's something that I haven't read your book, but I just have a sense that that's one things that makes it really good about you writing a book about meditation. Because, like you said, my biggest, bang for my buck, and that kind of thing about making it really practical to yourself. So what kind of businesses are very, really interested in having you come and be showing them the benefits of meditation and how that can actually bring more productivity and just a better well-being for everybody so that it helps their businesses?
Well, you know, I have to say, Robin, quite frankly, I no longer focus so much with businesses.
Okay.
I spent a number of years, I wrote on spirituality in the workplace for a training manual for the American Management Association. I spoke at the National Wellness Institute. I was, you know, tapped as being a chair of spirituality in the workplace in the local areas. And I was very involved with this. But, you know, quite honestly, after a good 10-plus years of doing that kind of work, I felt like I was putting Band-Aids on the walking wounded. Mm-hmm. And I could only support people, but I really couldn't give them substance. And I, you know, fundamentally, I just, I didn't want to be patching people up. I wasn't giving them substance in the soul. And I kind of withdrew from that. And I subsequently wound up going into the private practice that I've got. I still make myself available for businesses. I just don't market it so much because, quite frankly, spirituality is not necessarily a sexy subject when it comes to business.
That's true.
It may be with certain executives that recognize they want to get in touch with certain of these things, and it may help them in their leadership capacity and decision-making things. But by and large, you know, maybe if you're in California in certain areas, there's greater receptivity. But I've had a friend say that in Minnesota, everybody's Lutheran, whether they want to be or not. And, you know, it's just not the climate for it here.
Well, and I can understand that. So I have an older sister who lives in Las Vegas. And she actually got her spiritual degree in Santa Monica and wound up doing so. So she basically does, you know, spirituality in the workplace, laughter in the workplace, and really comes from that place. And, you know, I totally know what you're talking about, feeling like, you know, I'm in these trenches, and is it really making a difference? Because, you know, she's been doing it for 25 years as well. And she's just gotten connected with Zappos out in Las Vegas. And so, you know, just the last 5 to 10 years, there's been such a turnaround. And, I mean, I would think you would agree with me that just a sense of consciousness is just really changing. And, you know, it's kind of like movies in California. The movies get here, and then they go to – then they go – they start heading east, you know. The Midwest is at last minute, you know how that goes.
Well, and it is a kind of, how would I say it? It is a bit of an evolutionary process, and I think we'll simply be seeing more of it. But, you know, fundamentally, I'm a purist. I believe wholeheartedly in what I do, and I didn't want to prostitute what I had to offer just to make a buck. I realize that may sound high-minded or snobbish. I don't mean it to be that way. It's just, for me, it's very much of a calling. So when you've got that kind of calling, you still have to earn a living, and I've reinvented myself a number of ways, but it's very important for me to remain true to what I'm about and the message that I've got to offer. So the book is a platform that allows me to speak to that. My going back to get ordained as an interfaith minister allows people to recognize that when I'm talking about meditation, it's in terms of a spiritual practice and not just something else. And so I really do make an effort to support people and anchor them in that understanding, give them basically the tools and methods by which they can get enriched through that. And, you know, quite honestly, not everybody is interested in that comes to see me, and that's fine. I can still work with them according to where they're at. But at the end of the day, folks know where I hang my hat, and they can go as deep with me as they're willing to do so.
Yeah, I think it's really wonderful that it's the way you've really made it, getting to be a minister and really working from that level for just people to be feeling comfortable with it. And I think, you know, no matter where you live, that's still something that's very important for people to have a sense of that. And you were sharing once you had a story of a lady that was had been working with a food addiction. And
right.
I think that's really going right back to what we're talking about, just this personal thing. Because really it can come from like, yeah, we could work with a bunch of people in the business. But really for people to change and shift and really make the difference in the world, it's that one person at a time. And what that one person isn't just one person. It's their family. It's their community. And as they go out and they're shifted and changed, it changes everybody.
You hit it spot on. And what you also mentioned that there seems to be this rising change in interest, and that's, in fact, why I have the business that I do. Because many of the people that I see have been successful in their business lives, and yet during that process they felt a need to set aside their spiritual pursuits in order to raise a family, achieve their financial success. But they recognize that there's a hole, mm-hmm. and they need to play and want to play catch-up. And I wind up serving as a kind of go-to fellow because I have been in this so long, and I help to expedite a process for them. And it is one person at a time, but there are more and more of these one persons that are significantly interested in getting substance and quality that can really nourish them at deep levels.
Mm-hmm. It's like that, you know, coming to that one place where you really hold the message and hold a level of integrity about really embracing yourself on a spiritual level. And everybody, if they can come to that place of being really authentic and having their inner voice and owning and loving that they can take it out and show everybody that it's safe to do so. Because I think that's one thing, is just teaching people that it's safe to be able to honor your inner wisdom that you have.
Well, you know, most definitely, and yet, you know, spiritual practice is very much of a personal thing, and everybody that entertains it or engages with it, they're going to do so differently.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this is very much an individual's relationship with spirit and allowing them, helping them to deepen it, and, you know, it is a private kind of thing, and yet it doesn't really matter if people necessarily know what you're doing. If you're doing a quality practice and you're transforming yourself, by that very action of doing so, other people will be benefited. There's a saying that by the power of one, many are lifted, mm-hmm. or brought down. And, you know, frankly, with the kind of cataclysms that are going on socially and globally, I made a point to just kind of address folks in my Facebook, my website, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Don't get sucked into that, because the world will sucker you in through allure, things that glitter, or through alarm, things that obviously are disturbing. And in both cases, they tend to draw you into the drama. I said, you know, you're going to be better served by focusing on your spiritual practices, cultivating these things within yourself, going forward to meet people with that kind of space. And by doing so, you help to neutralize some of the toxicity that's being produced in other places. And, you know, it's a better way to go about doing stuff, and you can make a difference.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Last week I had actually gone to listen to a yogi at Lorenz's studio, and I wanted to get your opinion on something. He was saying that he felt that the perfect amount of minutes to meditate is 48 minutes. That's what I did. I laughed too, but I wanted to see what you thought about that. But he went on to say too that he said it's a matter of, he said, meditate for 5 and have it be authentic. Have it be in a place where you really feel like you're there and you're present, instead of having it be something where, you know, they call it rowing the boat when it comes to sitting and meditating,
sure,
where
sure.
You're nodding off and you've got the head going back and forth. It looks like you're rowing a boat. But
yeah, you know, I find things like that are just like they're laughable. You know, that's like sort of trying to tell some, you know, couple how much time is the optimal time to talk when you get home from work. Is it 3.5 minutes or should it be, you know, it's just ridiculous. You can't engage with these things that way. What I tell people is that depth is more important than length, but as you go and develop depth, if you can combine the two, depth and length, you'll get greater results. I usually tell people when they're starting, because everybody wants to know, how much should I do? I say, you know, if you can start off with 15 minutes twice a day, better yet, 30 minutes, twice a day, great, go for it. But, you know, I've had people who, they're so busy that even that kind of concept blows them out of the water. I said, okay, try committing to 30 seconds twice a day. Make the commitment, however, so that even if you don't feel like showing up, you do. And for those 30 seconds, give your all to it. And what, of course, 30 seconds, what are you going to do with 30 seconds? But it begins to build the habit. Mm-hmm. And we are habited creatures, so we have so many things that work against us. Make something that will work for you. The important thing is to do the amount that you feel is joyful to you, giving you something, but make a commitment and stick to it. And as you find that the payoff from it is increasingly pleasurable and beneficial, you'll naturally want to do more. And it's just like going to the gym. If you're in some kind of weight training program, you're going to start off with something light and easy, and as you train, as you develop, your program will develop more complexity and depth, et cetera, et cetera. The same thing with meditation. So you just start. You commit to something that you can do, and you do. And then over time, the more you do, the more you'll want to do. The less you do, the easier it is for it to fall away altogether.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, if you're a busy person and you tell them 30 seconds, that's going to feel like a lifetime.
You know, can't do better than
that. Yeah, I know.
So how? Say 30 seconds, you know, twice a day, then okay, then I can't do better for you, folks.
Yeah, but isn't it that gift you give to yourself? You know, it's that,
well,
you know.
The reality is that oftentimes people, their minds are so cluttered, and they find that by doing practices, let me just say that there's a great story. There's a Native American holy man, Fool's Crow, and he's kind of one of my heroes in the spiritual arena in Native American tradition. And he was highly sought after as a holy man, and there were times when he was just swamped with various different requests and ceremonies, rituals, and when asked, how do you prepare, how do you allocate the time for all this stuff, particularly as you get more and more busy, he said, I spend more time in prayer and meditation. Mm-hmm. it makes you, it sounds counterproductive. It's sort of counterintuitive, I should say. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, the more a person does these things, the more efficient they become, the greater their intuitional capabilities come forward, the more they're able to do things, and they find that they're creating more time that subsequently can feed into having more time to do a practice. So it's essentially, there's no downside to it. It is a win-win scenario.
Well, and that story reminds me of Gandhi. I mean, when Gandhi would have the same kind of thing, say these really things that he had to be dealing with, that's exactly what he'd do. He'd go into meditation for a whole day. And
he did that on a weekly basis.
Right, right.
He would go into silence, and that was, and this was a busy guy.
He was a very busy guy.
He changed India in relation to the British Empire, and this was not a guy who was frivolous with his time, but he recognized the importance of dedication for these things. And it's like basically any tool that you've used or you need to use, if you don't keep it in good shape, you're not going to be able to be effective with it. The mind, the consciousness is no different. We have to do these things in order to be at our optimal best. I say the spiritual element is at the core. How you might use that on a practical application basis, that's a byproduct, and it's a real one. But you need to do in order to get.
So what are some of the essential steps that we can use for cultivating and integrating meditation as a daily practice?
You know, one of the things that I found that has been a real obstacle for people when they want to learn about meditation, first of all, you have to have a good teacher and somebody that really knows their stuff. That is just a beginning point. When people are doing a practice, one of the things that I found that is probably the biggest thing for them is restlessness. People don't have quality education about how to deal with how to calm themselves. And I've said time and time again, and I teach this when I do my programs, I spend a fair amount of time with people with doing stretching or hatha yoga asanas if they're able to do so before doing any kind of meditation activity, because unless you do that, the body is holding on to so much stress that people are unable to sit still or to even register these concepts of calmness and peace and well-being. Their body is just overcharged. And so I say to people, one of the first things that you can do when you're learning to meditate is make sure that you spend time at first doing some stretching. It doesn't have to be any kind of athletic program, but just something that helps to break up the energy which is being stored and stuck in the body as tension. And when you do that and follow it with a meditative time, you'll find the benefits are, they're just, how would I say, it's very clearly noticeable.
Beneficial.
So,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, and it's night and day. I've had people who have said, you know, they haven't slept so well in forever. Very simply, you have to include, the body and mind are connected. The mind, body, spirit, they're all together. So, frankly, begin with the body, include that in your practice, and you'll find that the mental calmness and the spiritual elements that go along with it will simply benefit enormously.
Okay. And how do you feel about moving that with the breath?
You know, breath is a vital piece in preparatory practice. And the reason for it is, you know, sometimes people think, well, I'm doing breathing exercises, but all that goes on with meditation is energetic. It's about energy and consciousness. And breath is the tool that works the flow of energy. So there's a saying that as the breath flows, so flows the mind. And there's a whole yogic science called pranayama, which involves the control of life force energy. Breath is a mechanism by which life force energy is controlled. Learning specific breathing practices is effectively learning how to regulate the energy. Now, why? It controls the hemispheres of the brain and helps to balance the brain hemispheres as well as to calm down the rocky turbulence of the brain. So by working with quality breathing exercises, one has a great impact on the quality and clarity of consciousness. And so it helps to set the stage for meditative activities that will then follow.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like, well, yeah, it's basically if you're going to prepare a meal, there's a lot of prep work that goes into before you, you know, cook it and serve it. Breathing exercises, or what I'd like to say rather, the energy control exercises are very much part of that process in order that the outcomes are optimized.
It's like I'm a yoga, laughter yoga instructor. So when it comes to laughter and, you know, using the breath, but the abdomen breath and all that, and teaching people, like you're saying, to stretch, to, you know, really be, you know, coming from a lower belly, you know, laughing and breathing. It's amazing how quickly people can just like loosen up and just have fun and be able to be playful with the whole concept instead of, you know, worrying about, you know, doing it right or wrong. So that's one thing that I enjoy about the laughter yoga. So it's, yeah, similar practices. So we're going to be mindful, and we're going to be working with just some gentle movement and being conscious of our breath. What would be another thing that would be an essential step?
Well, I think I touched on it a little bit earlier, which is to make a dedicated practice. And it's important for people, I find, to, I would just say, set aside a portion of your house or your apartment that you're using just for meditation. And I'm just going to speak it, you know, as if we're doing this twice a day. Go to that room or go to that place where you are doing your practice, and twice a day, do what you're going to do for your spiritual practice there. And if there are, if you're sharing your space or house with others, let them know that this is, you know, Joseph Campbell referred to these places as sacred spaces. And when you designate a place like that, it begins to build up the vibration of your spiritual practice. And as a result, over time, it has a beneficial impact. So you create the habit in your life of doing something twice a day. It begins to work with you and on you. And when you go to this certain place in your house or your apartment, all these little things help to reinforce the benefit of your practice. For example, if I go away on a trip, I feel what happens when you go on a trip. You do your practice, but it's somehow oftentimes a little different. You come back to your home, you go to your meditation nook or room, and there's an energy which has been built up that automatically kind of shifts you into, oh yeah, I remember what, it raises you. So as I said earlier, meditation is about energy and consciousness. So doing those kinds of things that help to reinforce and build a quality, purified level of energy and to sustain it are going to be helpful. Another thing I'll tell people, particularly in the morning, water is a very purifying agent. Take a bath, take a shower, go do stretching, and then do your meditative practice. You'll find that this helps because it helps to clear the aura. And again, energetically, all these things benefit. If you're used to doing this kind of stuff at night, do it at night. You will still feel the benefit. The important thing is to establish a practice, commit to it, and do it.
Mm-hmm. So when everybody's doing it, where I'm sitting down, I've taken my shower, I've stretched out a little bit, I'm breathing, and I'm allowing myself to be on the mat, and I've got this mind chatter. How do you help people working with the mind chatter?
You know, this is where doing the stretching at first is very important, and then following it up with solid breathing practices, all of this stuff. When you get done with doing these kinds of things, the level of mind chatter, if you have been taught properly, is really, really ratcheted down. So I have to say that a person needs to really invest in this kind of preparatory stuff, because otherwise they'll be blindsided by all the restlessness of mind and body. So really doing some stretching, really taking the time to do proper breathing preparatory exercises is vitally important. Now, another thing that I do, but not everybody else does, is devotional chanting. And this is kind of a classic practice out of the Vedic tradition, but, you know, we see the use of sound and song in all kinds of traditions, whether it's Native American drumming, Gregorian chant, Tibetan chanting. This is another way to bring energy to the heart and to direct one's consciousness in a focus towards spiritual direction, and is a wonderful preparation to do in addition to these other things prior to going into specific technique. It's just a very potent thing that bypasses intellect and helps move a person deeper.
Do you think that's because part of it really, you know, you are working with the breath, you are working on just such a higher energy level? I know that when you're doing, the chanting, it's said that you're just your whole vibration just raises coming from the words and just the tones and stuff that you're using.
Yeah, exactly so. And the language doesn't have to be Sanskrit, Hindu, or something else. The chants that Yogananda taught were principally in English because his audience was Western. But what you're doing is you're directing your consciousness on the divine, on spirit. And by so doing, you axiomatically are raising your vibration. And chanting, when done properly, is very much like affirmation. It's a repetitive activity that with each repetition, you allow your mind to go deeper and deeper, not just into the words, but the meaning behind it. It becomes very much like a soul call. And as you go deeper and deeper, your ego begins to drop away and your heart, your soul come forward, and it becomes an intoxicating kind of activity that really raises your consciousness and makes it that much easier to go into a meditative practice following it.
So when you've got that as a regular practice and you're doing that, do you find that during your day there might be just some certain melody or chant will come into your mind depending what else you've got going on?
Well, you know, when a person does, and I've told people that that's one of the benefits of doing chanting, is that it kind of, you know, if you've heard a song on the radio that you like and you find yourself sort of singing it without really any prompting, I mean, the use of advertising with jingles, it's well known. It just seeps into your subconscious and all of a sudden you're singing about some burger or whatever. Where'd that come from? Well, you know, chanting is intentional. And when you're doing intentional spiritual practice, you start paying more attention. But when you do these things deeply, it's like the roots of a plant. They begin to go down deeply into your consciousness. And yes, you do find that you're driving along. And in fact, that's the benefit of having a CD player in your car or someplace. You can insulate yourself from the craziness of traffic, putting on a chanting CD, I tell you. It'll turn you around 180 degrees. You're looking at all this nutsness going on besides you, and you're in this kind of cocoon. It's great. And yes, during the day, you find that stuff comes forward. It's like a little occult soldier, if you will, an esoteric soldier that comes to your aid when you're being kind of bullied by the world around you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I can just see you driving down the road, and, you know, you've got it on. You're all, like, smiling and happy, and you're looking at all these other people, like, going, oh, my gosh, what's going on with that guy? He is just way too happy. You know, like, yeah, that's
yeah,
right.
True.
I am holding energy for everyone. It is good. That's really awesome.
That's
now, with your regular teachings that you do you offer recordings of like, meditations for timing and things like that, where you kind of walk people through the process? Or is it something where you basically, they come to class and that's when you're basically doing your teaching?
Yeah, it's basically the way my work is set up is if you imagine a therapist, people go for weekly sessions or what have you, and my thing is no different. I do have a couple CDs. One is a devotional chanting CD.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Heart Songs. Mm-hmm. And the other is a meditation CD called The Art and Science of Meditation.
Okay.
And this is an excellent kind of, if you will, complementary element. One of the reasons that I did it was to allow people to be guided through a process without having to read something.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the CD has a nice guided process so that people don't have to be trying to remember something, reading a book, flipping a page, closing their eyes, and trying for they can just put in the CD and allow themselves to be led. But, you know, that's not the bulk of my work. My work is really more individual with people. I also have a Sunday meditation service that I provide. It's kind of like a Sunday service alternative for people that want to have a church-like venue to go to, but it's more focused on seeking the kingdom within. So I facilitate a period of a guided process with, you know, the preparatory things that I just mentioned, chanting, a guided meditation, and then a brief teaching at the end. But it's not about the sermon. It's about helping to cultivate that inner experience. But, you know, that's public, that's donation basis. My other work is, just like I said, think of it like a therapist. You go, you show up, you work with the person, and that's what I do.
Okay, that's so wonderful. So who do you think would really benefit from your book?
Oh, well, you know, my intention was this. I felt like people that were complete beginners, that were interested in meditation and wanted to get something very substantive and understand the entire A to Z process, the why, the how. People that had experience with some kind of meditation, but perhaps their training was a little rusty. They were looking for filling in some areas. You know, there, I can't tell you the number of times that I've taught people that have never had the depth of training that I've provided. So they've done stuff, but they just haven't known the amount of information that this provides them, and it enriches their practice. So that's another group. Another is Hatha yoga practitioners. So many people are doing Hatha these days. I've had so many people that are allegedly yoga teachers. They're actually Hatha yoga instructors, and they know very little about spiritual practice and meditation from the yogic tradition. They have reached a point of maturity. They want to include meditative practice to enrich their yogic endeavors. That's another group. And then also mainstream religionists, people that are looking to enhance their personal relationship with God, spirit, the divine, however they language it, and they want to know how to do it. So, you know, all of those folks are, you know, wonderful candidates for this. And at the end of the day, you have to say why. And the why is because each and every one of them, according to where they're beginning and diving in, will feel so much better, so much more connected. These are not things that, how can I say, these are things that are really value additive to people's lives on so many different levels. So whether you're feeling more joyful, more connected, more integrated, you're finding your life is just enriched, and you wind up feeling like a new person as a result of investing your time and energy in these things, and it's like night and day difference for people.
That's so great. So how can people get a hold of you if they feel like they need a like to have a one-on-one with you, if they want to go ahead and get the book, or just have questions? We're going to actually invite everybody too, that we'll have a place under the show for people to go ahead and ask him some questions, ask Alan questions, and then we'll make sure that we can either have you on again, or we'll go ahead and make sure we get them forwarded to you and make sure that contacts are made.
Yeah, I'm always happy to assist. And my website is the best place for people to go. There's contact stuff there for them, information about the book as well. And it is awakeinlife.com. And I need to say that there's hyphens in there, so it's awake-in-life.com. So that's the best one-stop shop, the easiest thing for people to remember, make a note of. Go there. They'll find information. There's contact stuff. I welcome people. I invite them to, because it is a passion of mine. When people have quick questions that I can answer, I'm happy to do so. If they have more in-depth stuff that needs work, well, we just have to, you know, take it to that level. But very open to hearing from folks. I invite it.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you, Alan. Gosh, this has just been such a wonderful show. And thank you for writing the book. I look forward to, to getting it myself and checking it out. And I'll be having questions.
Well, yeah. And I look forward to continuing. And I'll say one last little thing about
it.
Meditation is a way of life, philosophy, and practice. You know, for me, I felt like on one level, if I didn't know what I do now, and I've been in these trenches teaching this stuff since 1984, say, for example, I came back reincarnated, whether you believe in it or not, but I wanted something that was really good that would help me get a handle on how and why and where to go with this stuff. And I really felt that this book was addressing that. And, you know, I'm a hard critic, and when I read it over, I'm pleased with the quality of information and substance for people, and I don't feel anybody's going to go wrong.
Well, thank you so much. You just did.
You bet. I thank you.
I have another question for you, just as a question for me. Have you ever been to the Lake Shrine?
Oh, of course.
Oh, of course. Gosh, that place to me is just so magical.
It is. Yeah. It's, you know, the vibes in places like that are phenomenal. Where spiritual masters have been, there's a energetic residue that lingers, and if you tune into that, you are definitely going to benefit. Where other people go for pilgrimage purposes, their holy intention and meditative energies go along with that. I'm a real fan of pilgrimage. Of course, the places that surround Yogananda and his life and teaching are particularly dear to me. But I've done the same thing in the Holy Land, places where Jesus had been, where, you know, various different places that different saints have been around the world I've gone to tune into those vibrations. It's a very real practice, and so what can I say? When you get a chance, go do it.
Yes, absolutely. And the Lake Shrine's over in the Santa Monica area.
Well, the Lake Shrine, is it? That's in L.A. That's in the Pacific Palisades.
Right, right. And if you go the first Sunday, they have the best chai in the world.
Good
deal.
You
go for the chai and stay for the meditation, okay?
Hey, whatever gets you there.
Okay. Well, thank you, Alan. Like I said, if we have any anybody having any questions or wanting to contact you, we'll make sure to be forwarding that on as soon as possible.
That's lovely, Robin. Thanks so much for having
You're
me.
You're welcome. Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the Transformation Cafe podcast. To learn more, visit transformation-cafe.com for show notes, guest information, and links to previous shows. You can also subscribe to the Transformation Cafe podcast on iTunes. Join us again next time at the Transformation Cafe, a fun place to nourish your soul.